This is the Mother Jones Podcast. I'm Jamila King in Oakland. On today's show, scared about childcare during the pandemic, daycare safety, school reopenings, plans are scrambled. There's no national strategy. If you're a parent, you're understandably scared, tired, wired. I know that I've got friends who are parents who are becoming superheroes and they don't have much good information to go on. They're just kind of making it up as they go. To soothe those aches and pains and give you some real info about pandemic parenting, there's only one expert we wanted to bring you today, Emily Oster. She's become a pop oracle for all things kids, COVID, and how to survive parenting in 2020. Stick around. Erin Wiener is a senior editor in DC. The reason we're talking to Erin today is because, Erin, you're a new dad. Well, 10 months is still pretty new, right?
I'd like to think so, although I did just see a photo of myself from back in the hospital when my son was born, and somehow I looked meaningfully younger back then. So I guess it's been a pretty long 10 months.
Give us the radio version of sharing some photos. How are things going?
Well, my son, his name's Cole. He's doing great. He's got two teeth. He loves saying da-da. Just yesterday, he gained a cool new skill, which is he started clapping when we say clap your hands. So that feels like a nice milestone. So, I mean, Cole's doing great. My wife and I are maybe struggling a little bit more.
What's the hardest part?
Doing my job decently. I think it's hard feeling like we're doing everything in a mediocre way. I feel like we're trying to parent and work at the same time, and it's just impossible to be good at both of them. And it's a strain, just feeling like you're giving it your all, but coming up short all the time, every day.
When your wife and you told your next door neighbor last year that you were expecting a baby, she ran inside, grabbed a book, and gave it to you. What was it?
It was a paperback copy of Expecting Better by Emily Oster, who's an economist at Brown University. And at the time, we'd never heard of her, but we quickly learned that she's kind of a rock star in this weird micro world of millennial parents that we now find ourselves in. You know, what she did basically was she took the genre of pregnancy literature and then also of baby literature in her follow-up book, Crib Sheet, last year. And she gave it what it was really missing, which was a dose of empiricism, and tried to explain to parents what they actually safely can and can't do, as opposed to the kind of shoddy prescriptive stuff that tends to be out there.
Why did you want to talk to Emily for Mother Jones?
So she is, as far as I know, the only economist who has brought together these two worlds. She studied early childcare, and now she's started to bring that same approach to studying COVID.
With schools and parents around the country facing tough decisions about safety and education, school reopenings have become very high stakes, a question of life and death, and plenty of gray areas. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so I talked to Oster to see if she could kind of bring together all this research to answer this big question about the safety of reopening schools. And I also had a more selfish motive, which was that I wanted her guidance, you know, an economist's guidance on what my wife and I and all the other many thousands of parents out there in the same situation should be considering as we think about whether it's safe and advisable to send our son to daycare this fall.
Here's Erin with economist Emily Oster.
We are talking in the middle of this nationwide July spike in COVID cases. And every day, pretty much, there are school districts that are deciding now that it's not safe to reopen schools in the fall. And I'm curious, given what you've seen in the data around infections at schools, whether you think this is the right response to this increase in cases.
I think in some places, yes, and in some places, no. So I think what we've seen is, you know, there are spikes in cases in some parts of the country, you know, Florida, Texas, California. And for those places to respond to that by not opening schools seems sensible to me. So I think that, you know, opening, we have not seen any examples of places that have opened schools with those kind of, you know, rising and large caseloads. And so I think that there's a lot of risk to doing that. And we can talk a little bit more about what exactly those risks are. I think the one piece that I'm a little bit more hesitant about is I think that we've seen some increased hesitancy about school opening in places in the Northeast, where the virus is fairly under control. And I think it would be helpful for the conversations about this to be a bit more localized and to sort of say, okay, it may be that it makes sense to open schools in person in Massachusetts or New York, even though there are cases in Texas. And the fact that the cases are rising in Texas should not necessarily mean that we need to adjust what we're doing in Massachusetts. And so I think there's a little bit of a balance there, and a way that we're not really used to talking about things in America because we're not really used to privileging states in quite this way. But I think we may have to in this case.
But it does sort of raise this question of like what exactly are the risks? And I'm kind of curious from your look at the data from Europe, where we've seen these reopenings that have not really led to many COVID cases. And, you know, from Israel, where there were a bunch of cases and some schools had to be closed again, like, what should U.S. policymakers think about the risks of schools becoming hotspots?
So I think that most of our data does not suggest that schools will become hotspots. The European data is a good example of this. You know, we saw some cases in schools. Maybe there were some sort of small outbreaks, but this has not been something that looks like it's really increased the spread of the virus, given the sort of circumstances under which they opened. The data in Israel is, I think, more concerning. And in particular, there's like one very large outbreak in a high school. There are a lot of schools that have closed in Israel, although I think it's worth remembering that basically Israel adopted a policy where if there were any cases in the school, they closed the school. And so, you know, that is a kind of a very high bar for how you would sort of think about the school closures. And so you got a lot of school closures, even for like a relatively small number of cases. So how should places, schools in the U.S. be thinking about this evidence? I mean, I think putting all of it together, it does look like younger kids are at the least amount of risk, and that opening schools for younger kids seems to be the sort of most safe thing of the different things that you could do. So I think that's one sort of concrete thing we might have learned from the experience of the places that have gone before.
Yeah. Since you're an economist by day, I'd like to kind of ask you about the economics around this too. We're always hearing about how bad it is for local economies when bars and restaurants and shops are closed. But have there been any studies of the long-term economic impact of keeping kids home from school?
I mean, I think what we can say is we can sort of triangulate into the possible long-term impacts of that. So we can look at, for example, what happened to learning in the spring. And what happened is kids did not learn as much at all as they were learning when they were in school, and that those learning losses were particularly large for low-income students, for students of color. So I think it's pretty clear that there will be some that, you know, as we go remote, at least for some kids, that will be quite bad for their learning. And then we know from sort of other evidence that that lack of achievement, that may translate into being less likely to finish high school, less likely to go to college. That has long-term impacts on wages, on longevity, on all kinds of other stuff. So I think, you know, there are potentially really, really large long-term impacts of these disruptions, which don't get that much discussion, but I think should be part of the conversation. I would also say there's a very direct economic impact here, which is that if people are home with their kids and not at their jobs, that's actually pretty bad for the economy as well. So I think that there's a sort of more direct and immediate part of this in addition to the long-term stuff.
Yeah. You mentioned kind of the socioeconomic angle here and the differences that different families are facing. And I think that's kind of the other economics question here, which is suddenly, you know, just in the past week, there's all this discussion cropping up of these private pods that upper middle class parents around the country are forming. You know, are you worried that a year from now that we're just going to end up with, you know, much wider educational gaps by income?
Yeah, I mean, I'm worried about that having nothing to do with the pods. So, I mean, I think the pod stuff is just sort of an interesting like phenomenon, which we'll have to see where that goes. And my guess is that we will see some forms of podding among that actually cross some of the income thresholds, that really this may just turn out to be like you have a play group supervised by a variety of parents, which isn't necessarily like a one percenter activity. But I think putting all of that aside and like the private tutoring and whatever, I think that there is just going to be clear increases in inequality associated with the fact that some people's houses have internet, and some people have the ability to like supervise their kid and teach their kid things. And, you know, there is going to be some like highly motivated parents who are going to be like, this is a great opportunity for me to sign up my four-year-old for like Zurn and get them, you know, really like ahead of the curve. And this is a great chance to teach my pre-K kid to read and teach my, you know, second grader how to do algebra on Khan Academy. And, you know, there are going to be some pushing. There's going to be some pushing like that. And at the same time, there are going to be people whose kids are not, you know, for various reasons, not able to access resources that they need to just do the basic stuff. So I think when we come back in a year, we're going to find that pre-existing inequities are larger. And that'll be true whether there's learning pods or no learning pods or learning bubbles or anything like that.
So I have kind of a personal agenda here in this interview, which is my wife and I used your two books to help guide us through pregnancy and through his early months. And now I'm hoping you can tell us what we should do in this weird moment as we face a question that I think, you know, many thousands of parents around the country are facing, which is, you know, should we be thinking about sending our son to daycare in the coming months? You know, I know you took a look kind of at the public data that was available on daycare since they didn't really shut down the same way schools did, and found that basically there wasn't any. And so you decided it was time to kind of take it into your own hands, right?
Yeah. So we sort of looked out at the world and thought, okay, like there should be some source for these information on like basically childcare settings that were open to essential employees. And just actually in general, in many places, childcare settings did not close and there wasn't any systematic effort to collect that data. There is one study that's supposed to come out of Yale, but it just hasn't come out yet. And so we collected some of our own in a sort of what I would describe as like a non-scientific Google form sourcing mechanism. But we have data now from about almost 1,000 childcare settings, which remained open and just, you know, have some information on the number of COVID cases. We're actually also tracking a bunch of larger centers that are open now and sort of asking them every week, do you have any cases? So there's sort of two ongoing pieces of that data collection.
Yeah. And what you found so far seems, you know, especially for younger kids, seems pretty encouraging. Can you sum up what you've found, I mean, with your incomplete, unscientific data?
Yeah. So I think the sort of two top line things that I would highlight is one, like the rates, you know, the rates in these centers were very low. So, you know, it's something like 0.2% of kids, 0.15% of kids, and about maybe 1% of staff. So it's clear that the staff are more at risk. Now that may well not reflect anything about infections in childcare settings, just that in general, adults are at higher risk. For kids, if you just took a random sample of people and asked who's had COVID, you would find it's more adults than kids. But in general, the numbers are really quite low. I think the other thing I would highlight, and we're seeing this coming out of the tracking sample too, that I think is for me sort of more reassuring, is that there are a lot of isolated cases. So like one way you could get to, you know, 0.2% is like a few places where there were really large outbreaks. And that would kind of suggest that there's a lot of spread like within the centers. That's not really what we see. We see a lot of sort of isolated cases where there's like a center with one case or two cases. And then they kind of like, that's all they have. And so I think that is something that I'm paying a lot of attention to and, you know, trying to understand a bit better in the data. It's not that there haven't been some outbreaks. So we've seen some sort of, particularly in camps for slightly older kids, we've seen some sort of well-publicized larger outbreaks. So it's not that that can happen, but it doesn't seem like it's happening in a lot of cases.
That's interesting. So if there's a daycare center with like one case, that implies that there's a good chance that the kid just, you know, got it somewhere else, got it at home or something and came in and didn't spread it to the center.
Yeah. I mean, the way that I sort of think about it is like, if you look to something like norovirus, like stomach flu, right? When you send your kid to childcare, any kind of childcare, if they come home at the end of the day and they say, Tommy vomited on the rug, you know that your kid is going to be vomiting on the rug pretty soon. And so are all the other kids because norovirus is super contagious. And so if you looked at a data set, you would see basically there are a lot of childcare centers with no stomach flu, but then the places that have it, like, you know, 60% of the kids get it because it's just like, obviously spreading within the population. So I was sort of looking for that. Like, does it look like you either get one and then you get a ton the next week? But even in the tracking sample, like we'll see cases where it's like, okay, this week there was a case, two cases in the staff, and then the next week there's no cases. So you're not seeing the cases go up. You're seeing sort of like somebody was sick and then they didn't seem to bring it to the center.
And part of the calculus is kind of this cost-benefit analysis too. And for school-age kids, it's becoming clear that distance learning is a pretty crappy substitute for the real thing, and kids are falling behind. And so there's a real benefit to sending a kid to school. But for infants, Are you aware of evidence that keeping kids home as opposed to sending them to daycare is hurting them in some way in the long run?
No. I mean, I talk a lot about this in Crib Sheets, sort of the question of daycare versus nanny, you know, and any differences that we can see across those kind of groups seem to be very small, you know, and kind of in inconsistent directions and probably not super causal. So I would have said, like, if you are worried, like, if I don't send my kid to daycare, they'll, like, never learn to talk to other people. That is not a concern. Plenty of people keep their 9-month-old home and it's no problem. And it's funny because in the book I spend, like, I would say the sort of tone is like, it's fine to send your kid to daycare because that's the thing people are often worried about. Like, oh, if I send my kid to daycare, they won't love me anymore. And so this is a sort of, everyone now has the opposite question, which is like, you know, is it okay to keep my kid at home? So yes, both are fine.
But I feel like in Crib Sheet, you were comparing daycare to nanny to stay-at-home mom or dad. And you weren't necessarily comparing them to stay-at-home mom and dad who are also trying to work full-time at the same time.
Yes, right. Yes, I was not aware that I was going to be, that people were going to be facing that choice when I wrote that book.
Is there any way to assess whether that makes a difference?
I mean, look, I think there is probably no way to assess whether that makes a difference other than to ask sort of how is it affecting you, right? So I guess the one place I would sort of pull on here is that I think that different adults have had very different sort of like emotional reactions to this process of being at home. And I think that sort of keeping in mind that adult mental health is actually a big piece of kind of family happiness. If having your kid at home is making you really stressed out and is making it very hard for you to sort of be the kind of parent that you want, or conversely, if sending your kid is making you so anxious that it's like impossible to function, I think then that is an argument for sort of doing one or the other. But I don't think, we don't have any evidence on kind of like highly stressed parents who are trying to work at the same time as taking care of their kid. That'll come after the pandemic. Research ideas.
Yeah.
Aaron Weiner is a senior editor in DC, and today he's bringing you his chat with Emily Oster, an economist at Brown University who's become a sort of pandemic hero to so many parents. Aaron, what's coming up next in your chat?
We talked about navigating that really hard balance between parenting and raising kids and not sucking at both when you're trying to do them at the same time and navigating the guilt that comes along with it. And we talked about what Emily herself is hoping for her kids in the fall.
Can't wait. We'll be right back. If you want to support the Mother Jones podcast, it's really easy. Just go to wherever you got this show, yes, the one that you are listening to right now, and hit subscribe. It really helps. Thanks. The Mother Jones stories you're hearing right now are brought to you by our listeners and loyal readers who fuel our work. Audience support makes up 2/3 of the Mother Jones budget and helps our team dig deep on stories that matter. Make a donation at motherjones.com/give to keep our nonprofit newsroom humming. Again, that's motherjones.com/give. Welcome back to the show. Today, our senior editor in DC, Aaron Weiner, is bringing us his chat with Emily Oster. Let's get back to it.
I mean, I think what we're ending up with, and we're certainly seeing some of this at home, is a lot of parents who feel like they're being mediocre parents and mediocre employees at the same time. And I saw one pre-pandemic study that found that having inadequate access to childcare was like getting a 5% pay cut in terms of the effect that it had, and that there was a disproportionate impact on moms. And it seems likely that that's only going to be augmented, you know, now during COVID times. Is there a risk that we're potentially taking a long-term career hit by trying to balance all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, that for sure, I think it depends a little bit on what kind of job you're in. I think a lot of people are worried that this is going to erode a lot of gains for women. Somebody used the word she session, like recession, but with a she at the beginning, as a sort of like to highlight the fact that for a lot of women, there's, you know, both increased job losses is associated, but also like you just like people are going to sort of step back from the workforce. They're going to realize like my kid like has to be in virtual school all the time and somebody's got to be supervising them. And, you know, I guess it's going to be me. And that, you know, faced, it's one thing to do that for a few months, but faced with an entire year of that, people may say, you know what, I need to take time off my job. And we know that those kind of breaks in work history are not good for long-term career prospects.
Are there any other big factors that jump out in terms of making this calculus?
I mean, I think, you know, I think one thing that I would think that I would say would have been sort of the top of my list was just what are the other circumstances of your family? So, you know, people, there are people who, you know, live with an elderly relative where you could say, yeah, you know, the chance of the kid getting sick is small, but, you know, it is possible. And they probably will, there's like, your kid will be okay, will be fine. I mean, like the risk to kids are very small. The risk to you, if you're like a healthy, non-immune compromised adult, you know, young adult are fairly small. The risk to your parents would be much larger. And if you are someone with, you know, with an immune condition, then that is going to be, so I think that's a piece of the puzzle that, that probably deserves a sort of initial, like a pretty long thought at the beginning.
So that is a real question for us. I mean, all four of our son's grandparents are in the mix now. If we were to send him to daycare, should we think about not seeing them anymore?
I think this is the hardest thing. I mean, this is the thing that we are struggling with like every day. And I wish I could tell people an answer because I wish I had an answer. And I feel like there is just a trade-off. There's like a childcare grandparent trade-off. We've been thinking a lot about, you know, are there ways to make that safer? So we're going to try to see my parents at some point. I think we're going to try to be tested first. So we're going to try to figure out, is there a way to get like a COVID test before we see them? So in the hopes that that will sort of reduce some of the risks. But, you know, I think unfortunately, there's no good answer to this. It may be that for you, you know, from your kid's standpoint, there's less value to the daycare than the grandparents, maybe not, I don't know. You know, my kids are older. Like, I think there's a huge amount of value to them to being out with other kids. And so that's kind of where we came down on that calculus, sort of childcare over grandparents. But there's no good answer to this.
Well, I'll tell you that for the grandparents, there's a big upside to having the grandparents in the mix.
No, it's true. And I mean, I think it's also even in the space of sort of making this calculus for us, like one of the pieces is like, okay, yes, there is some risk, but like, if we don't, like, there's also like huge mental health costs to like not seeing them, you know, and everybody is like very depressed about that in my family. And so it's like, well, maybe we are willing to take some small risk to kind of outweigh this mental health stuff.
So, you know, if we were to decide to go with daycare and then the number of COVID cases keeps rising, is there a tipping point at which daycare, you know, even though the spread at daycare is pretty low, at which daycare actually becomes unsafe and we should consider pulling our kid out?
I mean, so you're asking about like, is there a threshold like in the community or is there a threshold in the daycare?
In the community. I mean, right, if the number of cases doubles and then quadruples, you know, in our region and the country, like it's at some point, it's just, you just want to hunker down at home.
I mean, I think the way that I would say it is like probably daycare is a pretty low risk activity relative to other things. So if you're sort of sitting there and being like, yeah, I'm still comfortable going to outdoor dining, you should probably be comfortable with daycare. If your view is like, basically it's not socially responsible to like do anything except like take a walk around the block near my house, which is kind of where we all were in like, you know, April or March or around, at least around where I live, then I think that it also is not really a good idea to have your kid at daycare. So I think, you know, one way to think about this is kind of trying to kind of rank these risks. And there are some of these like pretty nice things that came out of Texas, I think, and kind of like thinking a little bit about, well, if I'm willing to do this sort of higher risk thing, then probably this is still something that I should be comfortable doing, or at least if I want to be consistent with my own thinking. And as I sort of get to a place where it's like, okay, actually, I really am not comfortable with that, then you might say pull the daycare also.
Is there a reason to think that it's even reasonable to ask toddlers to like wear masks and stay 6 feet apart?
You can't. I mean, no. But basically,
yeah.
I mean, you can like, kids are more adaptable with the masks than I would have expected. Like my 5-year-old has kind of no problem for, you know, reasonable periods of time wearing a mask. But I think to imagine if your view is the only way to safely open a daycare is for 2-year-olds to wear a mask and to socially distance, then I think you cannot open. You know, and I think that when we look at like the ways that these have been open in sort of like for essential workers, they do not require all the kids to wear masks. So I think that, you know, that data is kind of reflecting probably what more of the reality, which is like, if you're taking care of an infant, you can't not touch them, right? That's like not, this is just like not physically not possible.
Last thing I want to ask you, where are your kids going to be this fall? Have you decided?
Well, if their school is open, they will be in it, in their school. Yeah, I mean, so currently our kids' school has suggested that they will open in person, roughly normally, and they will be there if it does. I really hope.
Yeah, good luck.
My kids are already in camp, and it's really great. So, I mean, to be fair, it's like a 3-hour outdoor camp where you play tennis, so it's probably about as low risk as you get. But it's been really nice.
Nice, nicer for you or for them?
I think for both, actually. I knew it would be nice for me. I've been surprised at how much they seem to value like not being in my house all the time.
That's Aaron Weiner with economist Emily Oster. Aaron, what's the biggest takeaway from this chat for you?
I think for us as a society, it's that we screwed this up pretty badly. Schools are a relatively safe place. You know, if we had prioritized school reopening from the start, if we'd said shut down the bars, shut down the indoor dining and shopping, we are going all in on getting schools open, we could have been in a place right now where we're all sending our kids to school and they're safe. And it's sad that we're not there.
If Mother Jones readers want to check out more from this interview, where can they find it?
On motherjones.com, of course.
Aaron, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks, Jamila.
Hi, my name is Camille Squires, and I'm an editorial fellow in the San Francisco office. Right now, I'm fact-checking an exciting new feature story that'll be out on motherjones.com very soon. Here are the credits for today's show. Theme music for the Mother Jones podcast was composed by Micah Barrick at Hear Film. This episode was jointly produced, edited, and mixed by James West, our executive producer, and Molly Schwartz, our associate producer. It was mastered by James West, with additional podcast production by Mark Kalinowski and Jamila King. And credit where credit is due, Mother Jones is supported by you, our listeners and readers. So thank you.
That's it this week for the Mother Jones podcast. I'm your host, Jamila King in Oakland. And look, if you want to support the podcast, it's, again, very easy. Just go to wherever you got this show. Yes, the one you just listened to, and hit that subscribe button. I'll see you next week. This podcast is brought to you by Mother Jones listeners like you who donate to keep our newsroom buzzing. Help us stay on the beat. Go to motherjones.com/give. From PRX.